Facebook.com.
Well, once again, everybody, thank you for joining me here on this Monday, January 16th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour or so. We're going over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me here coming out of an NFL playoff weekend. That'll be our first segment here today. We'll chat with Joe Everett of NFL Draft Bible for our NFL weekend review and conference championship preview. Of course, recap what happened here during the divisional weekend. Look ahead to the conference championship weekend. We only have three NFL games left to go, at least three NFL games with any sort of meaning left to go here for the season. So we'll cover two of those here on this segment. Second half of today's show, Kyle Hunter, huntersportspicks.com for our handicapping the hardwood segment. We have a ton of stuff to get to, and Kyle's got something to do right after wrapping up the recording here. So we're going to cram a lot into today's hour broadcast. Without further ado, go ahead and bring in today's first guest. That is Mr. Joe Everett of NFL Draft Bible. Joseph, how are you today, sir?
Excellent. Last good couple of days of football and just getting ready to watch some more.
Yep. It was, it was nice that Sunday made up for some of the blowouts that we've had here early on in the NFL playoffs. We'll recap all of that. But before we get into that, I know that you are extremely busy here at this time of year. I know that, you carved out some time for us here to join the show, and I really appreciate that. I know you couldn't make it last week, but why don't you fill us in here on what's been going on in your day-to-day life lately?
Well, it's the All-Star Circuit for just all the NFL draft sites, NFL teams. I mean, you name it. Now is the real grunt work, so to speak, of the off-season. Last week, the only reason I couldn't make it was our first practice at College Gridiron Showcase down in Bedford, Texas, was Monday morning, and it was great. It was just a three-day event. That event is a little different, that they do not have a game, but they have three intensive scrimmages, and they have direct interaction with NFL scouts, asking them what drills would you like to see, who would you like to see in them, and against which players. So the NFL talent evaluators have a more hands-on approach for the College Gridiron Showcase. And that one, it was the first time I'd been down there in Bedford, but they gave NFL Draft Bible on our website pretty much hands-on access. We could take live videos, talk to any of the players, any of the coaches we wanted to. And it was a good week, or just a good way to kick off that process. And then this week it starts up in earnest again. I'm in St. Petersburg, Florida. Found a pretty decent hotel room for the week, and I'll just be going back and forth to Shorecrest Preparatory School and St. Petersburg High School as well. They have both of the practices for East and the West teams down here in Florida. And, well, the East-West Shrine, it's been going on for years, and I've been going to it for quite a few years, so it's good to get this week started off. And it the way it works, too, also, Adam, is like each of these events seems to be a real step up, not only in the intensity of coverage, but also the quality of players that you're looking at. So East-West Shrine game, there's a ton of these kids that are not only going to get drafted, but almost at a loss of like who to interview first. It's a really great group. And then next week, once again, we rinse, wash, repeat, and we go to Mobile, Alabama for the Senior Bowl and the Coup de Grace. So it's January is an action-packed month for NFL Draft Bible.
Well, and definitely I hope our listeners take advantage of that. I know there are a lot of people that really, really love the NFL Draft. So NFL Draft Bible does some of the best coverage that you're going to find, if not the best coverage that you're going to find, especially because, you know, you guys are down there, boots on the ground at the College Gridiron Showcase, of course, the Shrine Game and the Senior Bowl. So, what's it like for you on a personal level, you know, to be able to have this job? And I'm sure it's a job that, you know, a lot of people out there, listeners included, are very envious of. You know, what's it like for you on a personal level, you know, being able to talk to some of these kids? And then, of course, this is something we've talked about in the past here when we were looking at the NFL draft, is that, you know, then you have these players that, you know, you've made some predictions on, then you get to see them come to fruition.
Oh, yeah, it's twofold. I mean, coming into these events, you kind of have players that you've targeted, what you expect to see, and then how they perform in these active scrimmages and against who in these reps. But then also after the fact, after these events are said and done, pro days are in the books and the combine's all said and done with, well, then the draft, where do these guys end up? Do they make an active 53? So it is a lot of anticipation, a lot of work, but it really, you do get not only to know the players, but the whole event, it really is just a process. I mean, some people complain, oh, I'm living out of a suitcase all month at the Fairfield or at the date. You know, I don't care. I'm talking with NFL teams, scouts, agents, players. You know, to quote Marv Levy, where else would you rather be than right here, right now, kind of thing. So it's, you know, I'm not getting a per diem or a full salary like some NFL scout, but NFL Draft Bible definitely takes care of this. And it without their help, you know, I wouldn't be able to cover events like these. So, yeah, it's definitely living in the now and not even looking back. I mean, the Shrine and the Senior Bowl, these two events, yeah, I wouldn't rather be anywhere else.
Well, and this is one of the things I talk about for our listeners here, and to sort of bring it back a little bit to the handicapping side is, you know, Joe can give us that different perspective that a lot of people can't, because he is a talent evaluator. He's a scout. He knows what he's looking for. He knows matchups that can be exploited. And then, of course, he's familiar with a lot of these kids coming out of college. So, you know, those are certainly things that have a lot of impact here for us in the handicapping community. And we're very, very lucky to get Joe on a regular basis here on the show. But, Joe, we'll bring this back over to the NFL here. And I know that there's a few topics that you want to talk about with regards to what we just saw here during the divisional round. And the first one is that you want to touch on the Houston Texans. And, I mean, a lot of people could see this coming. This game wasn't the blowout that it looked like necessarily. Tom Brady didn't play all that well. Patriots had a kick return touchdown that really helped them through a slow start. But when it came down to it, New England just kind of wore down Houston.
It was. It was unfortunate. And the worst part about this is there was a lot of great effort on that defensive side. This team seems to be set up. They're basically right there, and I know everyone's going to say it. Yes, it's the quarterback, but even beyond that, it's who they've got in the right spots. And I hate to be such a devilish person here, but when Will Fuller dropped that deep pass, I just shook my head and said, yeah, that makes sense. That's what we saw at Notre Dame. And, boy, as fast as he is, and sure he runs some sub-4.3, you still have to check out at ball skills. And the sad part is that's probably the prettiest pass Brock Osweiler threw all year. And I think what really hurts this team is that Clowney, he just now is finally getting back to the level of what they expected. And he could even exceed that. So they're going to be a great team next year. There's no doubt about it. I think the real issues are going to be what they're going to do a passer. And then, of course, Wilfork, he's talking retirement. If they don't have Wilfork, they miss J.J. Watt. He's unsure with that back injury. They're going to need to look defensive line coming up this offseason. But, yeah, it's just more than anything, they deserve a shout-out of that. I still believe that's one of the better defenses in the league. And, yeah, it's just a shame they don't have the signal caller they paid for.
Well, and that's the thing. And you and I were talking about this before we came on the air here, that the consensus better quarterback in every one of these playoff games, 8-0 straight up, 8-0 against the spread. And, I mean, I guess there's a little bit of a disagreement probably that you could make with the Seattle Seahawks and Atlanta Falcons. There are some people that would take Russell Wilson over Matt Ryan. But for me, I certainly think, especially with Kyle Shanahan and what he's been able to do with this Atlanta team, you know, I think you have to side with Ryan here, at least for this year. So let's talk a little bit about the Seahawks. We'll go back to Saturday again here. Do you feel like Seattle's in a little bit of trouble now? And maybe, you know, their dynasty out there, so to speak, in the NFC West, maybe weakening a little bit.
The windows for any of these teams, I don't care who you are, only stay open so long. And I know most of our listeners might be thinking glass half full, but here I think it's definitely towards the negative. I mean, Thomas Rawls, he's not Marshawn Lynch. I still think Jimmy Graham, while playing a good year, is a shell of his former self. And they've got problems if they don't get Earl Thomas back, another guy whispering about retirement. I hope those are just jokes and some sort of reactions in the middle of the season because, yeah, it was evident without Earl Thomas in there. They were not contenders. And Richard Sherman literally is on that island, proving how much he's not worth that contract, in my opinion. I think he's been getting by on phenomenal back half help for the majority of his career. So that whole back half, I think, is still an issue. You know, their front seven is still in good shape. Drafting Frank Clark, I think, was a big help. Adding him to that mix, Cliff Averill and Michael Bennett, and they still have two great coverage linebackers. It's just really, I think, two areas where they frustrate the heck out of me. And, yes, it was a good story, their left tackle, George Fant, the basketball player from Western Kentucky, and I like what they've done, but let's just get an answer. Just draft a tackle. Don't pick one up. Don't turn some basketball player into a left tackle. Don't draft Christian Sicoli from Buffalo and turn him into a center. There's been so many offensive line experiments there in Seattle where I just think they'd be so much better served to get a blue-chip player there on edge to block some of these pass rushers and then get another receiver to compliment Doug Baldwin. Nothing wrong with Baldwin, but he is a number two in my books. I think they could do themselves a world of a good just second round, third round. There's plenty of receivers out there, plenty of big-bodied receivers. I wish they would pick one, but I would look at this team heading into next year, and but it really all hinges on Earl Thomas III and where he's at, not just physically, mentally.
To play devil's advocate, or maybe to set the scene here and provide a little bit more context, the thing about Seattle is that there's only one team in this division capable of rising up and unseating them, and that's the Arizona Cardinals. And they had a down year this year, 7-8-1 record, even though they were plus 56 in point differential. So things just didn't really work out all that well for the Cardinals. They had some injury issues and things of that sort as well. But I think the proper context here that we're looking is that Seattle's going to be a factor in the NFC West. They should have 4 wins a year over the Rams and 49ers until they start to figure things out. But I think that you're looking at this more in the context of, you know, their days of being a perennial contender, able to stack up against the likes of, you know, the Green Bays, whoever happens to win the NFC East that year, you know, the Minnesota Vikings, once they get Bridgewater back. You're more looking at it in that context, correct?
Absolutely. You know, them just showing up to the Super Bowl every year and getting the job done, I don't know. And even the years that they did, there seemed to be some sort of miracle that propelled them that way, a fake field goal, a Marshawn Lynch earthquake run, but whatever it is, I think we're still looking at half a team in my books, a really stout defense, great front seven, and a good scheme. But then they're pretending on sort of smoke and mirrors on offense and Russell Wilson to work his magic for the 1,200th time. I think that's just a little foolhardy. And, yeah, the construction of this O-line and who they're putting into it just sometimes kind of makes me want to pull my hair out. Even the trade they did to get Jimmy Graham and saying goodbye to that center that they had, I still would have to question that. And where their offensive line has been since that transaction, I'd actually make the management take a hard look at that if I was writing the checks.
Well, we'll go to Sunday here. In the first game that we saw, because of the ice storm that postponed the Kansas City game about 7 hours later, was Dallas and Green Bay. And this thing was an instant classic. And it certainly didn't look like it was going to be one, because Green Bay shot out to a 21-3 lead, looked completely unstoppable. A little bit of a different story in the second half, and Dallas, of course, got that really big touchdown prior to halftime with Dak Prescott just throwing a total dime to Dez Bryant. But Dallas loses 34-31. Lots of kicking on display here in the fourth quarter of this one. You know, if Dallas is going to give up 34 points, they're not going to win a whole lot of games. A lot of NFL teams aren't. But especially a team that's so dependent on the run, so dependent on ball control, dictating the pace of the game. So for Dallas, obviously this game didn't play out the way that they wanted it to. What do you feel like this team needs here going forward?
They really needed to get both the players they were looking at number four, in my opinion. It's unfortunate you can't have the best of both worlds. But at that four selection, they were staring at Jalen Ramsey out of Florida State and Ezekiel Elliott, and I think they made the right decision. But you just, if they could have got Ramsey, a guy that could play corner as well as safety, they basically need both, in my opinion. But another corner is exactly where they're headed, or just a game change in safety. There's a lot to work with here. And as you mentioned, Adam, they just kind of got away from their identity. It was basically forced by the score. But, yeah, how you don't just keep feeding Ezekiel Elliott. How many formations I saw, too, that were just five wide or four wide with Ezekiel motioning out as a receiver? And, yes, he can catch. We want to use him in the passing game. But from a schematic point, you really want to force the issue of, like, no, we'll hand it off every time, and you're going to have to deal with that decision. And they just didn't. I think also I would have just kept throwing jump balls to Dez Bryant. I don't care if it was Gunter, Randall, even if they put Quentin Dix on him, Dez Bryant's beating all four of the Green Bay DBs that they're trotting out there. So I hate to say it and throw Jason Garrett under the bus there, but a little bit of clock management, some play calling that was a question mark. And, yeah, if they need anybody, trade up for Malik Hooker and get that difference-making safety out of Ohio State, or maybe they sit where they are in the first round, Jamal Adams out of LSU, or maybe even a couple rounds later. I love Justin Evans out of Texas A&M. I think that he could be had in the third round, potentially fourth round, how it falls. But they need someone out there to be an authoritative tackler and also cover ground. And it's just what they've got in Barry Church is all well and good, but he's just a faux linebacker. They really need another safety that can run, and I think they'd have to get a difference maker there. But also a cornerback, this is a good class. They could look that direction as well. It's I'd say if I had to rank them, it'd be cornerback, pass rusher, coverage linebacker. The other thing that I took away from this game is that Sean Lee did finally play his first season with a full 16-game slate, and that's great for all the knee injuries he's had. But I thought he was a bit of a liability in pass coverage in this last game, and that's where Dallas needs to just, you know, be real, look in the mirror and say, are we going to survive again with Sean Lee? Not only is he going to make 16 games, but what do those 16 games give us and what kind of quality is he bringing to the table? Because that's another area where he's just not a spring chicken anymore. This guy is an NFL vet. So, yeah, I think it's all defense, defense, defense for the Dallas draft needs.
Well, and of course, another thing, too, about Sean Lee, if you're looking ahead, and obviously that's what you're doing now if you're Dallas because your season's over, if Washington's able to retain Kirk Cousins, we know about the weapons that they have in the passing game. If Philadelphia can develop Carson Wentz into that Doug Peterson slash Andy Reid type of offense, going to be a lot of quick throws over the middle, short outs, that type of stuff, things that make Sean Lee go sideline to sideline. So for Dallas, you know, the middle of that defense, really the whole back seven is a bit of a liability, like you mentioned. But let's go with a glass half full a little bit here for Dallas, because I know Dak Prescott was 24 of 38, did throw for three Bills, three touchdowns, had a couple of very nice throws to Dez Bryant. This guy proved, I think, that he can be that guy and give this Dallas offense a little bit more of a multi-dimensional look for next year. I thought at the very least, I mean, sure, it's disappointing, and you know, you can look back at all of Jason Garrett's flaws in that game, and there were a lot of them. The game plan wasn't great, and the time management, like you said, was bad. But I thought Prescott really stepped up in easily the biggest stage of his career.
I think his last two games have been very impressive, and they've shown not only just what we've seen off the field, but even pre-snap. It seems to me he's got a package of audibles, not just a one, we'll check out of this and do a gut run. He's got at least two or three plays to run out of this. So, yeah, I would agree. I've seen it definitely the last few games, and if he's not the man entering into next season, then Dallas is just taking crazy pills. The biggest aspect of this is that, like we're talking about, I don't know how much of this playbook he had coming into week one. If he's got that whole offseason just sort of marinating with Scott Linehan, yeah, only good things could come out of this Cowboys offense. So they really, it's unfortunate for Cowboys fans. I'm sure they're banging their head against the wall how we did not get this done, but it has to be glass half full. You really have to be an optimist looking at this thing because the entire court is young. I mean, your oldest guy is Jason Witten, and he's not exactly a difference maker for you anyways. As long as Dez Bryant, Ezekiel Elliott, and Prescott are coming back, that is a triplets that the Cowboys, they're just going to be able to hang their hat on these guys for the next 2 years, maybe more.
And, of course, you know, they can fix the defense if they make the right decisions through the draft and through free agency. So that will certainly be the goal for them. One more team to talk about here, and then we'll preview what's coming up this weekend. The Kansas City Chiefs. This is not a very big surprise, really, to be honest with you, that the Chiefs didn't manage a whole lot of offense here against Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's defense has been steadily improving throughout the year, as we'll talk about here in a few minutes. But, you know, Kansas City pretty much abandoned the running game, 14 carries against 34 pass attempts. They had 4.4 yards per carry, but you know, they got themselves into too many third and long situations, put this game on Alex Smith. And I mean, it's no knock on Alex Smith. The game manager label is there for a reason. He didn't go out there and win this game for them.
No. And it I wouldn't even put it on game plan. There's just not only throws he didn't make, but it's just kind of a flawed recipe. I mean, imagine if they had Jamal Charles running around in that backfield. I think three injuries kind of hurt the Chiefs, not only Charles, but Rodney Hudson out at center. And then Derek Johnson, that middle linebacker, it's just unfortunate he didn't get to see this game because that's the quarterback of their defense. He gets him in the right checks. They would have been able to defend the run a lot better, but more importantly, coverage assignments, that everything would have been more sound. So it's so unfortunate for the Chiefs, but I would have to agree. I mean, Alex Smith, he is what he is. And it seems that once you get him outside of that system and into uncomfortable throws, that's when the mistakes just start cropping up. I think when he had success even at San Francisco, it's largely because of the run game and the defense, and they just didn't ask him to do a lot. They're trying to replicate that here in Kansas City, but I look at this offensive line being a problem. Yes, Eric Fisher, Mitchell Schwartz, these guys are good, but once Hudson stepped out, that entire interior really let a lot through. Another thing, too, I don't know that Justin Houston was ever playing healthy this season. He had a few flash games. That game against the Broncos, probably his highlight of the whole season, and it's just gone downhill from there. So it's unfortunate, but I just look at this Kansas City team. They arrived to the party a little late and beat up, and it showed, which is unfortunate because the Steelers gave them every chance to be in this game.
Yeah, they certainly did. But let's talk about the Chiefs going forward here, because Oakland, you know, a team that there were some smoke and mirrors there to be sure, but obviously they've got things going on the right side of the offensive side of the ball. We'll see what they do with the defense here in the offseason, because they, like the Cowboys, need to fix that side of the ball a little bit. I think they're off to a little bit better of a start, particularly with a guy like Khalil Mack. But the Raiders need to do some things defensively. And then Denver, when Trevor Siemian was out there, I thought Denver was a pretty decent team. They still have a very good offense. I would say they're probably the second best team in the AFC West. Things just didn't really work out for them. Had some injuries at some bad times. If you're Kansas City, I mean, how worried are you heading into next season with an Oakland team that's clearly much improved and a Denver team that underachieved?
Yeah, you can't count Denver out because of the defense, and who knows what Vance Joseph's going to do. But, yeah, Oakland looms large with the accomplishments they've made this season. And then another, they're young, so they're a problem heading into next season. And how does Kansas City fix this? It's tough because they have a number of high draft picks littered around that defense. So I don't know that you throw a pick there. I think definitely the French guy at guard, Laurent Duvernay-Tardif, and then also Fulton, Ehringer. I don't know that they're really going to have any blue chippers. So I would get a world beater out of Indiana by the name of Dan Feeney would be my first order of business. And then also, yes, Tyreek Hill's dynamic. Jeremy Maclin got back from injury. Where's their other big receiver? That's something I'd love to see in the mix, because with a guy, limited placement, not a lot of torque on his balls, if you could throw jump balls to another bigger receiver, I think that'd play right into Alex Smith's game. As frustrating as this may sound to Chiefs fans, it's time to move on from Jamal Charles. There's been one too many injuries. Spencer Ware is a solid back. Charkendrick West, he's a Jag. I love him. Great story. But they need a real difference maker at running back, especially in Andy Reid's system, where how many targets go to the running back? How many checkdowns and screens and short passes do we see in Andy Reid's West Coast scheme? It would just behoove them, I think. Not only is it a phenomenal running back class this year, the depth. I really believe any round, be it first all the way down to seventh, you're going to get a quality running back no matter where you take them. So, I would think the Chiefs, wherever it happens, they got to take two. And that's at the running back position.
Well, let's go to Sunday here. We've got Green Bay taking on Atlanta, battle of a couple of gunslingers here. And in fact, we've got a total up around 60. This number was actually flirting with 62, which I believe is the all-time high for a playoff game, which was the Rams and somebody else, I think. I saw that note. I'll see if I can dig it up here as we're going along. But this one's expected to be a shootout. Atlanta is a consensus 4-point favorite across the market. This number opened 4 out in Las Vegas, ticked up as high as 5.5. Came back down a little bit, kind of moved around quite a bit after the game. But, man, I mean, you couldn't really ask for a better matchup than Aaron Rodgers and Matt Ryan here from the NFC.
Oh, fireworks. I mean, and that total's up there for a reason. Both these teams can score. I would expect kind of Green Bay to take the opposite approach to what they did just this last game. They may want to keep the ball out of Atlanta's hands, hit Ripkowski up the middle and get Devontae Adams, you know, going on these short routes while Cobb does a little bit in the screen game. But I don't know that they want to throw against an Atlanta team that is just fine and happy with a boat race. So, like I said, it may sound crazy, but clocking this game out, doing a little bit more with Ty Montgomery and Christian Michael might be the way for Green Bay. But, you know, the Falcons do have a beatable secondary. Their only legit corner, I think, is Robert Alford at this point. So Green Bay is going to be able to put points up. Where I worry, though, it's if Atlanta watched any footage of that Cowboys game, they saw Dez Bryant just eat Green Bay's secondary alive. If Julio Jones can't do that, I'd be shocked. So I'd look for Julio early and often, and also those running backs. Everyone knows how well Freeman and Coleman run, but I think they're both very gifted pass catchers where they're dangerous. And with those linebackers for Green Bay, I mean, say what you want. Yes, Blake Martinez could play. Joe Thomas is out there. They've just got another team. They really need some coverage packers heading into this draft. I don't know what they were thinking. Even Clay Matthews, I don't care who it is, none of those guys could run with Tevin Coleman or Devontae Freeman, and for that matter, Taylor Gabriel. Some of these plays, they're dishing in inside screens, inside runs that are, I think, just impossible to stop. So, yeah, that Taylor Gabriel for Atlanta is going to be a tough cover for the Packers, actually all of them. So I really am leaning Atlanta hard just for the simple fact that I don't know how Green Bay is going to catch up and just keep pace. And as great a story as Aaron Rodgers has been this year, I don't know if the magic may have run out.
This total, the highest in a playoff game since 1986. This is from ESPN Stats and Info on Twitter. Second highest for any game behind the 2000 Rams and 49ers game, which closed on 62. So, you know, I think that we'll probably see sharp money show up on the under here just for the simple fact that this is kind of an unprecedented, uncharted type of thing. But, you know, we'll have to see how that one actually plays out. Aaron Rodgers is just stupid good. The throws that he was making yesterday, particularly that one to put them in field goal range, I've never seen a guy throw on the run better than he does. And that's something that Atlanta really has to game plan for. It's Dan Quinn's bread and butter is the defensive side of the ball. So I think there's a lot of pressure on him. But one of the underlying things here, we kind of talked about this a little bit when Green Bay was struggling, is that, you know, I had read some things about Mike McCarthy being very vanilla with his formations, very vanilla with his play calling. I mean, you know, Aaron Rodgers is out there making stuff up on the fly, and who can blame him for that? What we do know about Atlanta, Kyle Shanahan, nobody game plans an offense the way that this dude does. Is that coaching advantage something that, you know, may even overshadow some of the X's and O's and the schematic things about this game?
I think it does. I'm a firm believer of that West Coast approach. That you script at least the first 20 to 25 plays, you go with those, and then you do your research and your in-game adjustments, which that's another area of McCarthy. I don't know how much in-game adjustments he's making. I would also argue some of those formations have been a bit vanilla. I'd like to see more motion before, like pre-snap, and that's one thing I'm just loving seeing from this Falcons offense. I think also if you watch that Kansas City game, they took a little page out of Shanny's playbook. They got Tariq Hill in motion. They move him in on that jet sweep. The entire defense buys on that side the jet sweep's on. And who's trailing Tyreek Hill but Travis Kelce? And they just do a little shovel pass right up the gut, and it goes for I don't know how many yards because they just don't see it coming. And that kind of misdirection and the movements pre-snap, I think, is it's paramount in the league today because we're basically boiled down to everyone can play that arrives. It's all just mismatches. It's all timing at this point. And, yeah, I would think there's a bit of an advantage just upstairs. You know, Shanahan, he may not be on the field. I still think that's to his advantage, just calling down, telling people what he sees from the bird's eye view. And by the way, on Rodgers, on that throw, that was against his body too. He's working magic out there.
He certainly is. I mean, I can honestly say I've never seen a guy with that kind of arm talent on the move. And to be that accurate and put so much zip on the ball, incredible to watch. And, you know, I think the nice thing here is either one of these NFC teams should make for an exciting you know, representative in the Super Bowl, because you've got two pretty good offenses, two good quarterbacks. If you give Kyle Shanahan 2 weeks to prep for the Super Bowl, things could get really, really interesting in that respect. So that's the nice thing here. I mean, obviously, you know, you root for the team that you bet on, but in this case, I really wouldn't be upset to see either one of these teams, you know, make it on to Super Bowl 51 there in Houston. AFC championship game, Pittsburgh and New England. New England, pretty much a consensus 6-point favorite out there. You'll find a stray 5.5. Touchdown Tommy and the Patriots offense didn't look all that great against Houston, but Pittsburgh hit a bunch of 3-run homers against Kansas City. They only had 18 points, all of them coming via the field goal. So kind of surprising to see both of these teams walk into this game with some offensive problems.
Just the lack of cohesion more than anything. I think both, I don't know if it's the time off for New England more than anything, but I think without Rob Gronkowski, some things have started to boil up to the surface here. You're looking at their top two wideouts being Chris Hogan and Julian Edelman. And Martellus Bennett took a shot in that last game. Yes, he's doing work up the middle, but looking at this matchup, I think they need a guy like Deion Lewis or James White, for that matter, to do exactly what they did against Houston, or else it may be a long night. I mean, they really use those running backs a lot, and that's, I think, Pittsburgh's weakness right now. Timmons is just a shell running around out there. I'm not saying I could do a better job, but, boy, he's not what he once was. And Shazier, I think that's another guy that may be playing hurt, because I've seen him do some athletic things. I know he's a top-tier athlete, but he's just not playing like it right now. I don't know if that knee's right from early in the season. So that's where New England's going to have some advantages, with those checkdowns, little screens, and intermediate stuff that the Pats, well, they've been doing it for years. Kevin Falk, it dates back. So, yeah, they need Deion Lewis to kind of have a repeat, I think, or else could be a long day. And I think the Steelers, they may have had their worst game of the season offensively, and it could only get better, in my opinion. With that frustration, they dislike the Patriots. I think it's going to boil down to the Butler versus Brown matchup, and that is, this is what the playoffs are all about. Best on best, ones versus ones. So that's just going to be probably your highlight of the game that night. But outside of that, Pittsburgh, they need to get the football to Eli Rogers. I think that little slot guy for them is nifty. If they could get more drags and curls, because the Patriots' nickelbacks and dimebacks, that'd be the area I'd look to expose, and Rogers could have a big game. He's a tough assignment with how quick he is in and out of his breaks. I think that's the one where they could really go, because New England's going to key in on Le'Veon Bell in that running game, and they'll just ISO Butler on Brown, and they'll want them to beat, you know, just make you beat us with something else. And I think Rodgers, he could be that answer for the Steelers.
Can Le'Veon Bell be stopped? I mean, this guy's basically doing at the running back position what Aaron Rodgers is doing, you know, at the quarterback position. I mean, Bell has just been remarkably good. He's also a workhorse back that seems to get better the more he gets hit. You know, can New England actually stop this guy and force somebody else to beat them?
That's the big rub. I mean, I've never seen anybody run like that. He'll come right to the line of scrimmage and a screeching halt and make the defense react and react off of that. He is, if he was in a boxing match, I'd have to believe he's the best counter puncher you'd ever seen, because he's basically feeding off of your move and beating you with the counter. And I just, I don't remember a back outside of Barry Sanders doing that, but even if you were talking about two completely different body types, yet Le'Veon, he's able to make it work for him. I think also you got to give a ton of credit for that Kansas City offensive line. They've also adapted to his style. They don't just go off fire, drive block, and it's not a zone scheme. It's something a little bit different what they're doing with those guys up front that allows them to have that success. So it's a unique bird that they're going to have to deal with in New England. But I have to imagine if they're not committing 7 or 8 in the box, then they're going to get hurt by Le'Veon, and I think the Patriots might be in a little bit of trouble here.
So that's what you're thinking? You'd lean toward Pittsburgh here at this stage of the game?
I'm leaning money line, Steelers, and definitely taking the points.
Interesting. A lot of great thoughts today from Joe Everett of NFL Draft Bible. Joe, let you get back to all the stuff that you've got going on. As we already talked about, great, great work over at NFL Draft Bible. I encourage all of our listeners to check it out. Follow Joe on Twitter at Joe W. Everett and at NFL Draft Bible. Joe, thank you so much, man. We'll talk to you again real soon.
All right. Looking forward to it, Adam.
Great stuff there with Joe Everett, and good to get a little bit of perspective there on what he's doing for Draft Bible and also all the great stuff that's going on with the College Gridiron Showcase and then some of those other events here to showcase, you know, what is the future in the NFL. Before we bring in Kyle Hunter, I've got to remind you of this. I do it on every show. Hopefully some of our listeners have taken advantage of it. DSI Sportsbook. You want to have as many outs available as you can here at this time of the year, especially if you're going to start really digging into basketball with college and the NBA. Those half points, those full points really, really matter. So head on over there. Use the promo code BTBRadio. That'll get you a $10 test drive free bet, no strings attached, simply for signing up. And then upon your first deposit, you get a 50 to 100% deposit bonus. So a great way to get your feet wet over there at DSI Sportsbook. As I said, we certainly recommend them. So that will bring in today's second and final guest. That is Mr. Kyle Hunter of huntersportspicks.com. Kyle, how's it going today, man?
Got to tell you, it's a little bit of a mixed bag here today. Had a long night last night up with a teething baby. So for that, running a little bit slow here today. Try to get things going a little bit here, get the mind working. But on the other hand, plays have been doing really well here of late. 20-11, last 31 college basketball, and 3-0 in the NFL playoffs so far. So that's a really good note to start on.
Yeah, it certainly is. Congratulations on those recent successes there, and hopefully you can keep the ball rolling with those. And, man, we have a long, long list of topics to get to here. We're going to call these – we call this the quick hitters, and we're actually going to try and make it quick this time as opposed to what we usually do. A lot of stuff to discuss here, including an update on a couple of things that we talked about last week. So – let's go ahead and get this fired up.
Yeah, first of all, the over came in at a 54% clip in the past week. The under dominated early in the season. The over's almost caught up for the year now. It's almost 50-50. So, you know, early in the year, there were a lot of neutral site games that went under the posted total, and that's something to keep in mind in the future. Neutral site games are a lot better for the under than our games at a site where you're used to playing. I think that makes a lot of sense. That's something to keep in mind moving forward, but right now there's not going to be many neutral site games until we get to conference tournaments and March Madness. The other thing about last week was the home underdogs that I've been saying would finally have value at some point. They did cover 56% of the time last week, and certainly not surprised about that. There was only so long that the road favorites could just continually cover ATS.
I have to ask, in terms of the home underdog, is it because we're getting some more of those tough situational spots with conference play where teams are maybe playing, you know, top 25 conference opponent, they wind up winning that game, go on the road, have a letdown, or is it just variance more than anything?
I think it's some of both. I think there was just, there was going to be variance to the other side because the road favorites have been covering so much. And then also you definitely get some of those teams that are in the second game of road trip a long ways away. You catch like a UCLA the other day, for example. That was one of the games that I wrote about in last week's Bang the Book situational spot article, which I'll be writing up today. Keep an eye on that one. I think that's a good article for college basketball bettors. UCLA played at Utah there last Saturday, and one-point win for them. They were lucky to get out of there with a win. That's the second of a game at Colorado and then at Utah. Really tough swing. That's always something to keep an eye on. You have several of those in different conferences where you can find some good home underdogs in those spots. Some injury notes that I wanted to give this week. East Carolina's coach, first of all, Jeff Lebo, taking an indefinite leave of absence after hip surgery. Assistant Michael Perry takes over. I'm going to assume that he does things pretty much about the same way because he's been on Lebo's staff for a long time. Also, East Carolina's B.J. Tyson averaging 12 points per game, which I believe is their leading scorer. East Carolina's really struggled to score so far this year. I mean, he led the team with 14.6 points per game last year. He's out indefinitely, possibly for the season with a knee injury. Now, ECU is a team that really struggles scoring the basketball to start with, and now they lack firepower even more. They really have to win these low-scoring games. It's going to be really hard for them. I think that these totals are going to be a little bit hard to play unders with, though, because I imagine we're going to start seeing some East Carolina totals, 119, 118, and those are really tough to take unders with.
East Carolina kind of caught Cincinnati in a little bit of a bad spot on Sunday. Cincinnati was coming off that game against SMU. East Carolina was catching 15.5 at home, and they covered pretty comfortably, but that was a 55-46 game, so 101 points in a total that opened 121.5 and closed 124.5. So I don't know if you've had a chance to dive into that one or not. I'm just sort of wondering if, you know, with East Carolina only scoring 46 points there, if maybe they did drop their pace a little bit there in that one.
The pace in that one was about average. East Carolina shot about 25% from the floor. They couldn't make anything. I actually heard some Cincinnati coaching notes after the game on radio, and basically the Cincinnati coaching staff didn't think they played very good defense. East Carolina just missed a lot of easy shots. The coach was trying to be nice about it, but he basically said that they didn't play well at all on offense. They didn't play very good on defense. Just East Carolina missed a lot of shots they should have made. So I think that's kind of a trend though that's been pretty consistent with East Carolina, as they miss a lot of open looks. So they caught Cincinnati in a bad spot. I think you should temper your expectations for East Carolina. Don't read too much into that game yesterday. The next note I wanted to say is Old Dominion, Brandon Stitt. Now, he's the team's best overall player by a wide margin. Tremendous shot blocker and rebounder. I've actually faded ODU in both of their last two games without him, and have covered both of those comfortably. He's listed as questionable for their next game against Charlotte this week. Definitely monitor his status. Old Dominion is not even close to the same team without him. They really struggled to beat Southern Miss the other day, and then home against Louisiana Tech the other day on Saturday. Louisiana Tech dominated Old Dominion at Old Dominion. So I think you definitely got to monitor the status of Brandon Stitt.
Well, and of course, Old Dominion wins with defense, and they play at a very slow pace. So missing that guy that's such a big key on the interior, definitely going to be something really big for them. And that's not something that a lot of people are going to realize probably, because I imagine on a team like Old Dominion where there are a lot of really impressive point totals anyway. I mean, he's a great rebounder and shot blocker, like you said, but only 10.5 points per game. So that's not going to cause a very dramatic adjustment in the lines.
Yeah, you're right. I don't think the adjustments in the lines are as much as they should be, because he's not a high-scoring guy that's going to get all kinds of publicity, but he's a really good player, definitely their best defender by a wide margin. And that's how they win games, is offensive rebounds with him. Shot blocks, good defense, so definitely a big loss when he's out of the lineup. Buffalo's Quate McKenzie is out indefinitely with a hand injury. And now McKenzie was a really highly recruited freshman who the team was really getting some solid contributions from. And I have to say, Buffalo has been the MAC team that's made the NCAA tournament the last 2 years. I really don't think that's going to happen this year, though. Buffalo is really inexperienced. They can't get things going. I think they do have a bright future. They're playing a lot of young players who I think could end up being good players. But right now, Buffalo seems a little bit in over their head here in the MAC.
Well, of course, that's something to keep in mind. And we talked a little bit in terms of travel for the MAC, and that Buffalo kind of out there on its own. They have some long trips. And this is an injury, like you said, it's a freshman who doesn't play a ton of minutes as of yet, but it really weakens their depth, especially if they're going to play consecutive road games with one of the directional Michigan schools, or they have to go all the way out to Ball State. So certainly something you want to keep in mind. And we like to do that from time to time. Actually, we've done that several weeks in a row here on this show, looking at home court advantages and talking about some of these conferences where maybe you're under or overvaluing some of them. Let's go to the American Athletic here this week. Again, another conference that's very, very spread out, much like Conference USA, covers a wide swath of land here in this country. What are some of the stronger home court advantages in your mind?
Well, first of all, Houston, I give them 5 points for home court advantage, and I've looked at this one a lot over the years. I have to say, I haven't totally figured out why Houston has a tremendous home court advantage, but if you look at the data year after year, they are much better at home than they are on the road. I have to assume that the very long travel for most teams in the conference has a lot to do with it. I don't think they have a great venue, Hoffman's Pavilion, 8,500 people seated there. So, kind of an average size, maybe a little bit smaller than the average one here in the American Athletic Conference. But Houston, they've just been consistently a lot better at home than they have been on the road. And this is a Houston team that I think is pretty good this year. They have Rob Gray, a guy who can really fill it up. And Kelvin Sampson there doing a pretty good job in the American Athletic Conference. Houston 13-5 on the year, so kind of quietly getting the job done this season. They're not going to do great on the road. Now, they did win at UConn. UConn was shorthanded in that game. But I do think that Houston can knock off some pretty good teams here at home this year.
Well, and 5 points. Let's talk for just a second here. What is your average home court advantage?
Average home court advantage overall or in the American Athletic?
Overall.
Overall, it's 3.5 points. It's about 3.3 points is my average in the database.
Okay. So when we talk about these ones that have an above average home court advantage, unless it's something like altitude or some really, really difficult shooting backdrop, you know, a lot of these above average ones going to fall in that 4.5, 5 type of range. We've got another one here in the state of Texas that covers about 4.5 points. Which team is that?
That's SMU. You know, Houston, SMU, and Tulsa can really catch some teams in bad spots like we talked about earlier. You've got the Houston, SMU, and Tulsa out there pretty close together, at least relatively close together. And then you've got teams like UConn, UCF, South Florida. I mean, that's a long ways away from there. You get a back-to-back playing at Tulsa, at SMU. That's one of those where it's a really tough spot. And Moody Coliseum has turned into a really great place for basketball. Great student section, gets really loud there. Have to give Larry Brown, their former coach, some credit for turning things around here at SMU and getting the students involved there. SMU is certainly a very tough place to play.
And there's certainly a team that looks like a pretty strong contender here despite that loss at Cincinnati, and we'll have to see how things go when those two teams have a rematch down there at Moody Coliseum coming up later in the year. This next one certainly makes a lot of sense to me because, as we talk about, you know, there are some very long travel spots here, and this one definitely out there on its own.
Yeah, UConn, 4 points for home court advantage for me. The people in Storrs, Connecticut love their basketball, and why wouldn't they? I mean, they have a men's team that has won it several times in recent years and a women's team that never loses a game. Again, a very long travel spot for the Western teams in the AAC. You can catch some teams in bad spots, especially if they're on a back-to-back road swing. You know, UConn, I think, is a team, like I said last week, that is undervalued right now. They did cover both their games last week. I had them in one of them, and I wish I would have taken them against Georgetown on Saturday. That was a lean that I didn't pull the trigger on. But UConn is definitely improving a lot here. Kevin Ollie's a good coach. You see these teams with good coaches late in the year start to really come on, and I think UConn's one of those teams. Certainly a good team to look to back at home. Like I say, 4 points for home court advantage, and I think they're going to catch some teams that you think are better than them here throughout the course of the season.
We like to look at teams that have above-average home court advantages, but also some of those that have a below-average home court advantage, and there's one that stands out to you in the AAC.
Yeah, you know, Tulane is one of those teams that, you know, they have the potential to have a good home court advantage because Fogelman Arena seats 3,600 people, and actually a lot of times when you have a really small gym, it's way, way smaller than everybody else's, you can have a really good home court advantage. In this case, though, it just hasn't been the case because Tulane gets almost no crowd support. The road team has just as many, if not more, people there than the home team. It's just a really bad spot for them right now. They're 4-13 this year. You can't blame anybody for not being too excited to go to a Tulane game. I give them 2 points for home court advantage, and honestly, that might be too much.
Well, as you're going through the season here, no matter what the sport is, you're looking for buy points and you're looking for sell points. Buy points are, of course, you know, when you find a team that pretty much has no value. We talk about this in college football. When somebody loses to an FCS opponent, that's a buy point for you as long as they're a decent team because everyone forgets about them. Everyone throws them in the trash. The flip side of that, of course, is that you have some teams that really aren't that good that get off to very hot starts, particularly against the spread. And if odds makers are getting burnt by a team, they're going to make some adjustments. So we got a few teams here that Kyle's looking to sell high, you know, and we like to talk about these. Sometimes they're long-term fades. Sometimes they're short-term fades, medium-length fades, whatever the case may be. But there are three teams here that you're looking to sell high on.
Yeah, first up is Fresno State. They're 10-3 against the spread. I'll be really surprised if they can keep that up. I think this is a mediocre team who can pull some upsets, but I don't want to consistently trust this team. The biggest thing that bothers me about Fresno State is they have very little depth. This is a team that does have some experience, but their bench minutes only 27.4%. That's 300s according to KenPom. So they're not using their bench much at all. I think that really hurts you later down the stretch. Fresno State, a team that I believe will tail off here, and I think the odds makers will be too high on them here in the near term.
And I think it's a really good point that you bring up about depth, because this is a team playing in the Mountain West Conference. So they're going to play high altitude games almost every time when they go on the road, with the exception of San Jose State and San Diego State. So definitely, if you don't have depth in the Mountain West, that's a pretty big problem, especially if you're asked to cover numbers on the road, which, you know, as you mentioned, they beat Boise State on Saturday. So it's probably a decent chance to look to go against the Bulldogs. You got a Big Ten team on your list here.
Yeah, Penn State, 10-5 against the spread. Now, certainly Penn State is much better than they have been, and I have to give them credit for that. But I think their upcoming schedule will expose them. They've got Indiana, at Purdue, at Wisconsin, and then home against Illinois, and then at Indiana. So you got some really tough games coming up. The Big Ten's a really good conference here at college basketball, especially as far as depth. You know, Rutgers is much better than they've been in the past. Illinois is not really a bad team. Iowa is capable with Peter Jock. Ohio State pulled that win yesterday against Michigan State. There's really not an easy game in the Big Ten. And I think Penn State is just one of those teams that they're certainly better than they have been in the past, but their offense isn't efficient enough to consistently keep covering games like this.
One more team on your list here, and actually we've talked about this team a couple times already here on the show, because you feel like you have – some games where the matchup really dictates going against them, but who is that team and why are you looking to fade them?
Yeah, it's Quinnipiac in the MAAC. This team really only does one thing well, and they do it really very well. It's offensive rebounds. They really crash the offensive glass. They do it too much to where they leave themselves open to runouts. They've covered the number several times by an extremely small margin here lately, and I think now's the time to sell on that. Really tough schedule coming up. They play arguably the three most talented teams in their conference in their next three games. Quinnipiac, if the price is right, I'm going to look to fade them here in the near term.
Well, like you said, when it comes to offensive rebounding, they pretty much sell out, right? So they get beat in transition, and that's why you're sort of looking for spots to fade them, particularly against teams, as you said, that are pretty talented. Because if there's one thing about the MAAC, it seems like there's some pretty big talent gaps from top to middle to bottom.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you get a lot of teams who really like to run. If you can grab a defensive rebound and run, Quinnipiac's in some trouble. 10-4 against the spread, they're certainly better than they were last year. But I still don't think this is one of these teams that you can count on to continue to cover like this.
Well, one of the things that we like to look at here is tempo, and sometimes some of the games that we isolate wind up being pace wars where you've got two contrasting styles. But Kyle's area of expertise in college basketball is looking at the totals market. So you're constantly looking at teams that are speeding up, slowing down, making some changes based on injuries, all those types of things, maybe shuffling the starting lineup. So you got a couple of teams here that you wanted to bring up for our listeners on this segment.
Yeah, first up is Missouri. Now, inside the SEC, they're averaging 77 possessions per game. That would make them the seventh fastest-paced team in the country if they were playing that overall for the season. So Missouri has really been playing fast. Kim Anderson inserted Jordan Barnett into the lineup and has helped the offense somewhat. Now, I have to say, Missouri's offense is not good at all as far as efficiency. They're averaging 0.95 points per possession. That's really bad. It's in the bottom 50 in the country. But when you play, you know, games at 80 possessions like they did against LSU and Georgia, you're going to play some high-scoring games even if you can't shoot it very well, because that's just a ton of possessions. And I think that the odds makers are still a little bit too low on their tempo. My top play from this past Saturday was them in Arkansas over the posted total, and that one got there pretty easily. So I think you're going to find some value here coming up with Missouri over for a little while, just because Missouri's offense is nothing flashy. They just have so many possessions in a game that's going to end up high scoring.
Well, that's always an interesting thing when you can't score. You know, do you feel like if you have more possessions but you're not efficient, you're just going to happen to score more, whereas if you slow it down or keep it where it is and you can't score, you kind of limit yourself. So that's always an interesting dilemma that coaches face, and something that you certainly want to keep an eye on as we go throughout the college basketball season here. One more team that you wanted to mention here, we'll go out to the West Coast Conference. What's going on with San Diego?
Well, San Diego is 11-3 to the over this year, and I'll be the first to say I was really surprised to see that they've had so many overs this year. San Diego, a team that really stalls. They play very slowly. They're 330th in the country in average possession length on offense. They're using about 20 seconds of the 30-second shot clock on average. They've been shooting it a lot better than they did last year. Their defense is down a little bit from last year. But I have to say, I think there's going to be some regression to the mean here. I'm going to look to play unders with San Diego, especially when they're playing like-minded teams in the WCC. Now, there can be some big pace wars here in the WCC because you have some teams that really want to push the tempo, other teams who like to slow it down. But, you know, when they play a team, say, a Santa Clara or a St. Mary's, you can get some really low possession games, and I think those could be some good spots for unders.
Well, to wrap up today's show, I want to look at a few games for a variety of different reasons. One of them generally tends to be a little bit of a premium look ahead from Kyle's card. Of course, the line has to make sense for that to be a thing. But the first game that you want to look at here, Notre Dame and Florida State, this one coming up on Wednesday. The Seminoles pick up that big home win over Duke. Then they go out on the road, struggle with North Carolina, couldn't really stop the Tar Heels. Now they take on another pretty decent offensive team, but they do get this one in Tallahassee.
Yeah, and this is a bad spot for Notre Dame. There's no doubt about that. They're playing their third consecutive really tough road game. They won at Miami 67-62. They won at Virginia Tech 76-71. Now they go to Tallahassee. This is a tough spot for them. Notre Dame's a team that has been a lot better than I thought they'd be so far this year. And I have to say, I don't think Mike Bray gets enough credit for how good of a coach he is. Every single year, this offense is extremely efficient. You know, they do a really good job taking care of the basketball. Third in the nation in least turnovers. They're shooting 83% from the free throw line, which is going to win you a lot of games just by itself. And their defense is better than it's been in previous years. They're good at defending without fouling. But this is a really tough spot. You know, you've come off two road wins, close road wins against quality teams. Now you go play Florida State, who is the most talented of the three teams they're going to play on the road here. The only thing that could save them a little bit here, you could certainly argue that Florida State's not in a great spot either because they're coming off a 96-83 loss at Carolina where the game was played at 85 possessions. You know, that's one where you have to wonder if maybe Florida State shouldn't be trying to run with North Carolina. That's 2 years in a row that they've done that, played a game 85 and 86 possessions. It hasn't worked out either time. I feel like North Carolina is just so good at running that it kind of puts Florida State at a disadvantage. So in this one, to me, you know, you have to look to play Florida State if you're going to take either side. But I'm not sure I'm going to play this one. Florida State's going to be favored in this game, maybe by 4 or 5 points. And to me, Leonard Hamilton, not as good of a coach as Mike Bray. So that's a little bit of an equalizer as well.
For Florida State here, this is their fifth straight game against a team that's effectively in the top 20. Virginia Tech was 21 when they played them, and they won that game by 15. Then they've got Louisville coming up here next weekend on Saturday. Then three straight road games at Georgia Tech, at Syracuse, at Miami. Is Florida State a team that you're going to look to fade once they stop playing these elite-level teams?
You know, Florida State's a team that I was really high on in the preseason. That's worked out so far. I do think Florida State's really talented, so I probably won't look to fade them, but, you know, I feel like you kind of have to lay off of them some here because Florida State's a team that, like you said, has played some really good teams here. They're going to have some letdown spots, and I still don't think that Leonard Hamilton is one of the best coaches here. There's a lot of really good coaches in this conference, and I don't think he's one of them. He hasn't proven it. So to me, you know, he's a little bit below par as far as coaching, so probably more than anything, I'll just stay away from Florida State games.
We'll move ahead to Thursday here where Davidson takes on LaSalle. This is a long, long trip here in the A-10. Davidson's in about that's about a half hour or so north of Charlotte on I-77 in North Carolina. LaSalle all the way up in Philadelphia. So a long trip here for the Wildcats. What is it about this game that piques your interest?
Well, here's the premium look ahead. Last week's did well with Miami and Notre Dame staying under the post total. We're going to look at another total look ahead here. I'm going to look to play the under in the Davidson and LaSalle game this week. Now, LaSalle has been shooting lights out in the last few games. I mean, it's just been insane the way they've been shooting the ball. And I think that's going to inflate this total. You know, you can't keep shooting the way that LaSalle's been shooting on a consistent basis. Jordan Price is a really good player for them. B.J. Johnson's come on really nicely. This is a LaSalle team that's certainly better than I thought they would be. And on offense, they're pretty efficient. But LaSalle doesn't play very fast. They've slowed down a lot in the conference, only 67.7 possession. And Davidson is not even close to the same team that they were last year. Davidson's playing much, much slower, not shooting the ball even close to as well. Last year, they were averaging 1.12 points per possession in the conference. So far this year in the conference, 1.03 points per possession. So Davidson really struggling. On defense, they're a lot better than they were last year. So you see a lot lower scoring games with Davidson overall. I think this is going to be a pretty high total, mid-150s, something like that. So I'll say this. If it's 154 or higher, I'm definitely on the under. If it's below that, I'll have to think about it. You can send me a message, and I'll follow up with you as to whether this is a play or not. But I think this is a good spot to find an inflated total where both teams are really not playing that fast. It's going to take some pretty insane shooting numbers to get over the total.
Any worry that LaSalle's giving up over 78 points per game? I mean, are they that bad defensively, or have they just had some things not really go their way?
Yeah, LaSalle's not very good defensively, and that's certainly one of the reasons that their games have been high scoring. But, you know, inside the conference, they're actually a little bit improved on defense. 1.07 points per possession overall, 1.02 inside the conference. So they've been a little bit better on defense here lately. And like I say, you know, if you're playing a 67-possession game and you get a total of 155 or something like that, just on principle, I have to take the under. You know, they may shoot lights out and beat me, but, you know, I have to pay to see it. So this is one of those where I like the spot for the under. I realize that both teams are capable of shooting really well, but at a tempo like that, you know, I have to like the under.
One more game to hit on here for this Monday Handicapping the Hardwood segment. We're going to go all the way out to Saturday. Look at Baylor on the road at TCU in Fort Worth. Baylor, of course, was number one, got blown out by West Virginia, had a nice bounce back win over Kansas State. I know we're looking way ahead here in this one, but what is it about this game that you're looking at?
Well, first of all, I have to say that I think there was quite a bit of pressure on Baylor when they hit that number one spot. And then, you know, going to West Virginia is a really tough trip. You know, I think that was a nice bounce back win, like you say, at Kansas State. That one maybe flew under the radar a little bit. But that was certainly a really good win there from Baylor. I don't think Baylor is a good enough team to win at all this year. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think that Baylor, you know, their number one ranking was certainly overrated as far as how good they actually are. I think they're more like the, you know, eighth or tenth best team in the country, not the first, not the number one team. But you know, Baylor has been really good this year. Like I said, you got to give Scott Drew credit. Now, the other thing I wanted to say about this game is take a look at TCU and how well they're doing. 14-3 on the year. Jamie Dixon is doing a really good job. I think Jamie Dixon was a little bit underappreciated at Pittsburgh. I know that they didn't find a lot of NCAA tournament success, but Pitt was consistently good under Jamie Dixon. And now TCU, a team that's been under 500 almost every single year. Their best year lately was 18-15 in 2015. This is a TCU team that is just playing much, much better here this year. And TCU, to me, this is a really big game for them because TCU is trying to prove that they're for real. You know, they're 14-3 on the year, but they've played a pretty weak schedule as far as their non-conference was a weak schedule. So TCU, even though they have a really good record, it's certainly not a shoe-in to make the NCAA tournament field. This is the type of win that could be a signature win for them. I think TCU will be a really small underdog in this one. My lean would be TCU, but not a real strong feel for me. I probably won't play this one as a premium. More, I want to just look at the fact that I think this is a really big game for TCU. It's a bigger game for TCU than it is for Baylor.
Well, in a potential tricky spot for TCU coming up next Monday, they're in Stillwater against Oklahoma State. So very, very quick turnaround from this 8 o'clock Eastern tip on Saturday against the former number one team in the country. So maybe TCU, you know, could be a tough team to back there in that one. But, you know, as you mentioned, looks like there'll be a short dog on this one coming up on Saturday. Kyle Hunter of huntersportspicks.com. What's going on over there at the website right now?
Well, if you haven't already, go over to huntersportspicks.com and sign up for the free picks newsletter. Winner yesterday on the Dallas and Green Bay over, that was the free play to premium or to sorry, not premium, to newsletter subscribers. 43-21 in my last 64 plays that have gone out to newsletter subscribers. So check that out. And also follow me on Twitter, at KyleHunterPicks. Going to be doing some more with my Twitter account and the email subscriber list. I'm going to be doing some contests where people can get free premium plays, things like that. So check that out if you haven't already.
Well, Kyle, thank you so much for your time, man. Really appreciate it. We'll talk to you again next week, buddy.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you.
Great stuff there from Kyle Hunter of huntersportspicks.com. Really strong show here to open up this week of Bang the Book Radio. Coming up on Tuesday, we'll have our Tuesday meeting show. We're recording this evening with Sports Cheetah for our Hunting for Winners segment. And we'll start things off with Brian Leonard of wagertalk.com for our sports wagering talk segment. We'll chat NFL playoffs with him. Also had a listener question about the setting of lines that odds makers do, all the work that they do to put, or all the work that they go through to put together their own personal numbers. So that'll be something I'll ask the rest of our handicappers throughout the week, and something I'll check on with Kyle next week. We were a little bit pressed for time there because he had something to take care of shortly after recording the show. So that's something I will ask him about on next week's broadcast, but I'll fill you in on the rest of the week on tomorrow's show. That'll do it for me. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.